From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rebecca Ward, filling in for Carol Castiel. Joining me on the program is Rick Pantaleo, broadcaster and producer with VOA's Current Affairs Desk. Rick is the author of the popular Science World blog and host of the science edition of Press Conference USA. Today we're talking about one of the world's most precious resources on Earth, water. South Africa has been in the news a lot lately because of a severe drought and water crisis. The Western Cape region has been the hardest hit, with the specter of day zero looming over the large, bustling, and popular tourist destination of Cape Town. City officials have said the day is coming when the taps will be shut off because of a lack of water. While day zero has not happened yet, the water shortage is citywide and affecting the entire population, with restrictions on the amount of water that can be used on a daily basis. Agriculture, of course, is also suffering with a lack of rain, including South Africa's famed wine region, where production is expected to drop by more than 20% from 2017. But South Africa is not the only country facing a water crisis. All around the world, a number of regions and countries are grappling with drought and a lack of drinkable water. And according to Charles Iceland, the director of Global and National Water Initiatives at the World Resources Institute, there are at least four water reservoirs on the brink of a major crisis. Charles Iceland joins us now to talk about the water crisis and how we might be able to avoid such issues in the future, or at least somehow prepare and mitigate the effects of a drought or water shortage. Charles Iceland, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Rebecca. Glad to be with you.
I should start off by saying South Africa has recently had some rain, but that in itself also causes problems because of such dry earth. The water you have typically runoff. Yeah. But first of all, let's start with, what is the cause, or how did they not see this coming?
Let me start out saying that Cape Town's actually done a lot to reduce its water demand, to address this chronic problem it has. Beginning in the mid-90s, they took active measures to reduce demand. And over time, in the past couple decades, even though their population has grown by a lot, their water demand has stayed pretty fixed. For that, I think they deserve kudos. I think the problem here, Rebecca, is that they've seen an unprecedented drought. It's a three-year drought. It's not like anyone they've seen in recent past. You probably have to go back 100 years to find something this powerful.
I think I read that 321-year drought is what, or something like
okay.
that. It's the worst drought. Well, of course, I don't know how far back the weather calculations or the drought calculations go, but I had read that it's one of the worst. However, I did read that they didn't expect it to happen this quickly, and that some of the criticism has been that they were a little slow to respond to the water crisis,
yeah,
or what was looming ahead of them, because they didn't really project it this close. They thought they had another year to prepare.
You know, again, they're not very different from the rest of us. Denial plays a big part in people's thinking. You get to thinking, well, certainly it can't be a three-year drought. You know, we'll get rains before such and such a date. So they may be the victims of wishful thinking. Also, though, they don't have any emergency stores to go to. They don't have, for example, desalination plants. They don't have a large store of groundwater nearby that's been discovered. What they've got in the reservoir systems, what they've got, and the water can go quicker if the drought is more pronounced than you think.
But the drought is not the only cause of a water shortage. Is that right? There are other factors.
When you're looking at water quantity, the two major variables are demand for water and supply of water. So you can either have diminishing supply, which we see here in the historic drought, or you can have very high demand, which, you know, to a certain extent, there's a sizable demand in this fairly arid region of the world. There's 4 million people. While they have taken some measures to improve water use, they probably haven't done everything they could. So there's that demand and supply interaction. Pollution can play a large part. In fact, a few years ago, when Sao Paulo was getting dangerously low with their water availability, one of the key issues was not so much that they didn't have enough water, but that the water they had was getting more and more concentrated with pollution as their reservoirs dwindled, and it just wasn't usable.
Hasn't this problem of water scarcity been identified for, like, decades now? Hasn't scientists, haven't people known about this? Well, why is it taking people by surprise now?
You can go back 4,000 years, Rick, and see lots of powerful civilizations go down because of extended drought. I think as long as humans have settled into civilizations with large communities, this has always been a risk. In terms of more recent times, I'd say, again, we suffer a lot from denial. This might be a problem, but it's sometime off in the future. Or this might be a problem, but it's not my problem. So
I think we think of a kind of a city or a sophisticated city like Cape Town, not dealing with the same kind of problem that other parts of Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, might face. And so I think that's what is surprising for the average person who thinks, how could this happen in a cosmopolitan area like Cape Town?
There are even wealthier places than South Africa that are beset by this problem. We had horrible drought in California a few years ago. We have ongoing drought in Spain and Portugal. So it's not that just because you're wealthy and advanced technologically that you are impervious to this problem.
I'm curious about the term or the saying, I guess, day zero. I've been reading about it in regards to the crisis in South Africa. Exactly what is day zero and how is the date calculated?
I'll give you a layman's answer because this isn't something I've looked at very closely, but I interpret day zero as the day in the future when the municipality is going to turn off the taps and start rationing water out via public water supply stations, and that people will only be getting 25 or maybe it's 50 liters a day. I'm forgetting now which it is, but some incredibly small amount of water compared to what people usually use on a daily basis.
In your blog on the Water Resources Institute, you mentioned four water reservoirs that are in serious trouble. Why don't you go ahead and name those for us and then talk about what are the issues facing each one of them?
Well, we looked at the Al Masira Dam in Morocco. That's the second largest dam and reservoir system in Morocco. We looked at the Mosul Dam, which has got notoriety in recent past in Iraq. It's a huge dam, and it supplies a lot of Iraq's urban water, and also it provides water to irrigators. We looked at the Indira Sagar Reservoir in central India, and we looked at the Buendia Reservoir in central Spain.
So you mentioned dams, and that is a type of water management system that can be good, but it can also cause some problems for countries or regions or areas downstream.
Sure. A reservoir is one way to store your water. You could also store your water in groundwater. Sometimes people rely on water storage in glaciers or in snow, such as California does with the Eastern Cascades. So a reservoir is one additional way that humans can store water. The reservoirs build up in the rainy season and they get depleted during dry seasons. So in that respect, they're kind of neutral, except dams and reservoirs can cause problems. So they can cause problems for people downstream. So for example, if you decide to build a new dam, and people downstream used to rely on water, and their water is not coming through in either the amounts or the timing that they're used to getting, you can disrupt their livelihoods. And that often happens with dams.
I think there was, I recall reading perhaps last year about the Yangtze building dams, and that was affecting some of the other countries downstream from China. And then, of course, the Nile. There are a number of dams. I don't know if it's the Nile or tributaries of the Nile, but there are some dams that are causing water depletion downstream. So how does that affect the whole cycle and the livelihood of people who live on the water?
There are several high-profile cases. You've cited a couple of them. So right now, the Ethiopian government is building the largest dam in Africa. It's called the Ethiopian Grand Renaissance Dam. It's being built over the Blue Nile, which supplies about 85% of Egypt's water, the water that arrives in Egypt. So there'll be some time to fill this very large dam, during which Egyptians and Sudanese who live downstream can expect to see less water flow. But that's probably not the biggest concern. The biggest concern is as Ethiopia starts to control the water, they'll begin to divert some of that water to their own irrigation, or that Sudan will take advantage of the fact that now there's a steady supply of water coming from Ethiopia, and they'll start irrigating their farms. And so that water will be permanently lost to Egypt. I'm not sure exactly what percentage of their workforce relies on agriculture, but it must be huge. Somewhere between a third and a half is my guess. And if you have, on a large scale, farmers no longer being able to earn their livelihoods, you're going to have real social pressures. You know, these people will have to leave their farms. They'll probably migrate to cities. The cities probably won't have sufficient jobs, especially not at first, to accommodate them. And you could see social strains in places like Egypt or other places where they're facing similar challenges.
This may be above your pay grade, but who steps in and says, you know what, you can't do that because of the effect on these other countries? There have been some doomsday, you know, warnings about the biggest conflicts in the world are going to be caused by the lack of water.
There's no god or goddess who's going to spring out of nowhere and tell people, thou can't do this. Instead, it's up to these three countries, Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia, to work it out.
A water treaty like Colorado has with, I think, Colorado, California.
There are seven states in the U.S. and Mexico that share water from the Colorado River Basin. So there, it's seven states and two countries that have to negotiate amongst themselves. And those negotiations get very acrimonious very quickly. The U.S. Supreme Court often steps in as the ultimate arbiter in the United States.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Charles Eisland, Director of Global and National Water Initiatives for the World Resources Institute, a leading environmental research and advocacy group. I am Rick Pantaleo, host of the Science Edition of Press Conference USA, along with VOA's Rebecca Ward. And here's a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab at our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. And here's a shout out to one of our loyal listeners, Evang Joe Kofi, who lives in Lafia, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the air, just send us an email to PCUSA@VOANews.com or like us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Now back to our program on water crisis with Charles Eisland of the World Resources Institute. Charles, stepping back a little bit, we've heard about efforts to contain the crisis through water rationing. How effective is water rationing, and what kind of rationing are we talking about? I mean, you mentioned an example, kind of an extreme example, of what could happen once day zero hits South Africa, but there are other methods of doing water rationing, and how effective is it?
Well, water rationing of the type that we would expect after day zero in South Africa is an extreme emergent situation, and there you'll have people lining up by the millions with jerry cans to fill up and get their allotment of water. It'll take these people all day and all night to sift through these lines. It will cause huge problems for the local economy, of course. So this isn't any way to really manage a problem. This is just what you do in absolute emergency. You know, there are similar situations in many other parts of the world that happen on a recurring basis. So in Maharashtra, India, for example, where they've been going through a multi-year drought, water trucks come by villages which have basically lost all access to water. And so they come by once a day, and people line up, again, by the thousands or tens of thousands, and they get their water. What you can try to do on a more proactive basis is try to reduce your water to a more sustainable level, put a cap on your water use, and then make allocations to irrigation, to municipalities, to industries, and for power generation, and make, you know, only allocations that make sense on a long-term sustainable basis. So that's how I would counsel cities that want to avoid this fate go through a rationing system.
Okay, beside rationing, what are some other strategies for saving water?
Well, let's go to the main problem that we see, whether you're in developing or developed countries, it's usually agriculture. Agriculture consumes about 80% of all the water that's used around the world, even in the United States, when you look at a consumptive use basis. So if agriculture constitutes the majority of the problem, it probably accounts for the biggest part of any solution. So with agriculture, one thing that a lot of countries do is they use flood irrigation. They basically divert water from a large river, and they'll flood farms, and the soil will get moistened and crops will grow. But that's a very wasteful way of using water. A lot of that water just evaporates into the air without having led to any growth of crops or anything. So a much more efficient way to use your water in agriculture is through a technology called drip irrigation. And here you're just applying water literally drop by drop at the roots. There's very little loss through evaporation of the type I just described. So that's one thing they could do. Another thing is if you're in a dry region of the world, don't plant very thirsty crops. So thirsty crops, examples include sugarcane, rice, cotton. Don't plant these crops in very dry areas. And it seems like that would make sense and that people wouldn't plant these crops in these regions. But you'd be surprised to see how much countries will allow planting of these crops in very dry areas. So those are two key things you could do to step in and right away have a big bang for your buck.
There are some drought-resistant seeds being created for rice, for example, which is huge crop all around the world. I want to get back to some of the solutions for the water crisis and what's being done in South Africa, from what I've read, is kind of interesting. Individuals are stepping up, and maybe that's why they've averted day zero. They're actually taking showers, keeping a bucket, I guess, in the shower, taking that water, using it for their laundry, using it to water their house plants. So on an individual basis, there are a lot of things that people can do to kind of conserve water and avoid the crisis when you realize you're coming up to it. I think the key here is knowing when you're coming up to such a level of crisis.
Absolutely. One of the main things you need to do in order to become a water-saving society is to cultivate a water-saving culture. So the fact that everybody in the city of 4 million is aware of water scarcity being a problem, and the fact that they're taking shorter showers, that they're looking at ways to reuse gray water. For example, you take your bath water and you'll use it to water your garden, for example. That's a very important thing to do. On the other hand, just looking at urban domestic use of water alone isn't going to get you huge savings because, as I mentioned, 80% of the water is used in agriculture. Only maybe 10% of the water is used in private homes.
Talking about the reality of a water shortage, water scarcity, a few years ago, most probably know about the severe drought in California, and they had to issue some very serious rationing rules and guidelines. Do you think, because of the visibility of California's crisis, that perhaps it will have some kind of impact on people and control of their water supplies?
Well, I like to think that people can learn from others' mistakes. I think, in truth, few people do learn as much as they should from other people's mistakes. So I don't want to be a pessimist, but usually people have to go through their own crisis to learn. And even then, we're not certain that they'll learn. For example, my understanding is that since the drought broke in California, a lot of folks have been going back to their profligate use.
Their old habits.
Their old habits. You know, okay.
Putting lawns in. That's the craziest thing. A
washing
lawn
your
where
cars.
Yeah, a lawn in the desert. That's about the most useless use of water that you could pursue.
I have read, or it's been a question of inequity. And in South Africa, it's I mean, the rationing, the or restrictions, rather, is citywide. But do you see an inequity with the scarcity of water? Or are we seeing more vulnerable communities having less access to drinkable water? Forget having, your morning shave or taking a shower, but are we seeing a lot of inequity in places like Africa and Asia?
Yeah, I mean, there's inequity even in the United States when there's a problem. So the poor are always the most vulnerable. They have the fewest options. A rich person can buy a couple plane tickets and leave until the drought is over. That's not an option. Running away is not an option for a poor person. And there's a lot of evidence as well that for getting emergency rations, it costs poor people more than it costs rich people. I guess that's a double whammy. So not only can you not afford the cost as much as your rich neighbor, but you're actually being charged more in absolute terms because maybe it's harder to get to your neighborhood than it is to get to a rich neighborhood where the transportation routes are very easy and direct and so forth.
Besides water rationing, water-saving solutions, what about relying on technology like desalinization? What kind of technology advances are out there that can be used to kind of rectify this water shortage?
Desalination is a technology that governments in the Middle East, including Israel, and the city of Melbourne and cities now in Orange County, California, they're starting to build this capacity. But this is just for emergency use because it's very energy intensive and therefore very expensive on a per gallon basis. So this isn't something a poor country, for example, could use. And it's not something that a rich country could use on a very long-term basis either. Not until we find much less energy-intensive ways of taking the salt out of salt water.
What about solutions looking long-term? What can we do? How much is climate change playing a role in drought? How much is one of the things that I see is as we saw in the Dust Bowl in the 30s, is strip farming. The whole evaporation cycle process is affected by strip farming. So yeah. What are other solutions that we can focus on long-term worldwide that would help mitigate any kind of cyclical droughts? I mean, they happen.
Yeah. Well, so there's wastewater treatment and reuse. This can be done within industrial plants. It can be done by energy companies. It can be done even within municipal systems. So in Orange County, for example, they take gray water and they inject it into groundwater sources. And in that process, it goes through a natural filtration process. And then they pump it back up for reuse. So that type of wastewater treatment and reuse is very important. Other ways to make your water go further is to not pollute your water. So in a lot of developing countries, there's very little treatment at all of wastewater, and it goes right back into rivers, into lakes, into groundwater. And as I mentioned in the example in Brazil, the more you pollute your water, the less water you have available to you. So just treating your water can go a long way towards freeing up a lot more clean water that people can actually use.
Beside natural changes such as climate change, droughts, extreme weather, and so forth, another factor would be, I would say, population growth, wouldn't it? And especially since there's a trend of people moving from rural areas and settling in urban areas, so you got concentrations of people, so you got a little bit of room for water and more people that are demanding it.
Definitely population growth is putting a large burden on water resources. So in places, for example, Syria had a population of 4.5 million people in the early 60s. Now it has a population above 20 million people. In Turkey, they had 30 million. Now it's 80 million. And in a lot of countries in Africa and in parts of Asia, a population's growing by leaps and bounds, and this is putting more pressure on our water resources, on our land resources, on our forests. But there's also another pressure that we're seeing, and that's just by virtue of us getting wealthier. wealthier people use more water on a per capita basis than poorer people.
Mm-hmm.
So you see countries like India and China finally breaking into the middle class, and this is a great thing. We should celebrate it, but that's more people using more water in those countries, and they're putting more pressure on their water resources.
One statistic that I came across when we're talking about the impact of population and population growth was from the UN. They say that water use has been growing globally at more than twice the rate of population increase in the last century. Your thoughts?
Yeah, well that's the point I just made about getting richer is that your water use is going up faster than even your population growth rate, which is already pretty quick. We've seen water use far outstrip population growth over the past century.
I have to ask you about this because it's almost amusing, but it's also intriguing. A gentleman by the name of Nick Sloan, who is a marine salvage expert, has suggested pulling icebergs to South Africa to help with fresh water, to help with the fresh water. I mean, it's apparently being taken seriously by some people. You may not know about this one in particular, but what would be your thoughts about some of the, you know, cloud seeding, that kind of thing, about some of these more, might seem far-fetched, but who knows? We put a person on the moon.
It's a great idea if he can do it for a price that people can afford. So moving water is very heavy. It's a heavy substance. And so when you try to move it, you're going to expend a lot of energy moving it. And if you're going to use a lot of energy to bring it someplace, the cost of it's going to go up. And there are very few people who can probably afford to pay that gentleman his cost and a little profit to haul that iceberg behind him for I don't know how many hundreds or thousands of miles. So
I'm curious as to how the best way for this water crisis to be addressed, regionally, locally, nationally, internationally?
Well, you know, different problems demand different tools. So I like to say that all water is local. And so when you really want to roll up your sleeves and solve a water problem, you're going to have to get down to a pretty local level and see what the specific problem is and what are the available solutions. On the other hand, sometimes you need the intervention of two different governments, whether they be state governments or national governments, to intervene if this problem is occurring across borders. So, for example, right now there are two Indian states that are fighting over water in one of the reservoirs we just looked at, Madhya Pradesh and Gujarat. So these two states are actually Gujarat, the downstream state, has appealed to the organization that runs the entire basin to see if they can force Madhya Pradesh to release more water downstream to alleviate the drought. So sometimes you need to go up to state or national or international bodies to try to mediate.
Since the UN put out that statement about the population growth versus the use of water, are they addressing this at all? Is it being made known to the countries that are members of the UN that this is a problem? This is a very serious problem that perhaps we can't avoid from happening.
Well, there is an effort underway to try to get the UN Security Council to take these issues of water scarcity up on a systematic basis and in a more formal way. There are holdouts in the UN Security Council that are pushing back. They're saying, this isn't the type of security threat that we deal with. So they're very ensconced in old types of security threats, nuclear war, pandemics. I think, though, the more certain member states push on the UN Security Council, the more times this happens, the more they'll be paving the path for the Security Council to eventually take this up.
I think that's about all the time we have. Thank you so much, Charles. I appreciate you coming in.
Oh, a pleasure.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. Joining me on the program was Rick Panaleo, host of the Science Edition of Press Conference USA, and I'm Rebecca Ward. Join us again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.